the counselors at his outpatient program asks if he'd be willing to give up his writing for his recovery. Stringer realizes that he has been clinging to the idea of finishing Grand Central Winter the way a shipwrecked man clings to a reef. He observes a continuous ribbon of desire running through his life, not just his longing for the drug, but his longing for writing as its substitute. The rough edges of his recovery story resist the burden of providing a seamless arc. Get addicted. Tell the story. Get better. His book confesses that his story won't be over, even after it gets told. The summer of my relapse, I did much of my drinking on crutches. The month after Dave returned from Greece, a car ran over my right foot, leaving the bruised imprint of tire tracks across my swollen arch. I'd been wearing flip-flops. At the ER, I mainly wondered which painkillers they'd prescribe. At home, in the aftermath, I tried to be as self-sufficient as I could, fetching things for myself, balancing coffee and plates while I crutched, because I hated the idea that I would yet again be asking Dave to care for me. Though, of course, part of me wanted that more than anything. Whenever I drank on crutches, I felt like a cartoon character. One night, I tripped coming down the Foxhead stairs, crutches clattering as my palms braced against the asphalt, and thought of that one-legged magician back in Nicaragua. Back then, I'd thought, you should take better care of yourself. Now I was the one hopping along, balancing my crutches against tables so that I'd have a free hand to hold my drink. Most mornings, I faced my fictional Sandinistas with puffy eyes and a dry mouth from the other side of a gauzy curtain. I'd hoped writing could burn off my hangovers, like sunlight burning off fog, but they were stubborn. The novel was still inert, which seemed like little more than a confirmation of my solipsism. Once I tried to write beyond myself, it seemed I had nothing to offer. As Charles Jackson lamented to a friend about his sober attempts to write outside himself, as soon as I am not able to be personal, my writing falls apart. I would hit the end of a paragraph and stare into the blank space beyond it. I could go anywhere, I'd tell myself, trying to remember what possible had felt like. I'd think of what we had in the fridge. Half a bottle of Chardonnay, 3 PBRs. I'd check the clock. How many hours till dusk? It was impossible to do bakery work on crutches, and I missed being useful in a simple, basic way. Jamie brought me little Tupperware containers of melted chocolate and cones of parchment paper so I could make cake decorations from home, where I sat on the floor, next to our window unit air conditioner, because every other part of the apartment was too hot for the chocolate to harden, and sculpted rows of little daisies. Meanwhile, I tried to reboot my novel as magical realism, something I'd sworn I'd never do. Who wanted to see a woman in Iowa writing her magical realist account of a Nicaraguan revolution? Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick describes the way an addict projects consolation, repose, beauty, or energy onto his substance, what she calls beauty delusively attributed to the magical element. And I was doing that in prose and life, looking for gods from the machine, asking drinking to supply my pulse, asking my jungle gorillas to spot luminous beehives in the trees. I spent long chunks of time in my hot apartment trying to tell myself I had the drinking figured out. It had gotten bad because of my depression, but now I was medicated. Or it had gotten bad because of me and Dave, but now we would work better. Or it had been recovery itself, convincing me I was alcoholic with the Mobius strip of its logic. If you don't think you are an alcoholic, then you probably are one. What bullshit was that? There was no way out of it. Sure, it felt true that I wanted to drink every fucking night. But maybe I just felt that way because I'd sat through enough meetings where people talked about feeling that way. I'd taken on the identity because it had been a useful way to sort out my sense of self at the time. Now I resented meetings for polluting my relationship to drinking. It was like the joke about two drunks who'd seen The Lost Weekend. When they came staggering out of the movie theater, the first one said, "My God, I'll never take another drink." And the second replied, My God, I'll never go to another movie. There was a little voice in me that considered the possibility that perhaps there were people who didn't spend hours every day trying to decide if their desperate desire to drink had preceded recovery meetings or been created by them. But it irritated me, that voice. I tried not to listen to it. The whole project of moderate drinking was maddening. The first time I ever heard the phrase, drinking to get drunk, I actually found it humorously tautological. Of course you drank to get drunk, just like you breathed to get oxygen, which was part of why moderation was like constant acrobatic contortion. After work one night, at a pub called The Sanctuary, the other girls from the bakery were ordering beer. The Sanctuary was known for its beer. So I ordered beer too, instead of something stronger. But I carefully checked the proof for every beer on the menu so I could order the highest one. I always go for an ironic name, I said, explaining why I had ordered the Delirium Tremens, then added, I hate beer, before ordering three more. In August, I organized a birthday dinner for Dave at a farmhouse outside town where a French expat had a wood-burning oven in which he charred pizzas to black blistered perfection, walnut and sage, blue cheese and mushrooms. We ate on her porch while a lightning storm lit up the cornfields, and it was insanely beautiful. That humid night breathing through the screens, crackling fingers of electricity across the sky, hot cheese and crisp dough in our mouths. I crutched across the rough-hewn floorboards, nearly fell headfirst on the way to the bathroom, and wondered, why do I have to get drunk to find this beautiful? For a long time, I'd thought of my drinking as the opposite of anorexia, as abandon rather than restriction. But I was beginning to see, during my days of attempted moderation, that my relationship with drinking was a direct extension of those restrictive days. Starving myself meant resisting an endless longing, and drinking meant submitting to it. But both times it was the obsession that shamed me, the sense of being consumed by a desire that was so limited in its object. When I restricted my eating, I was ashamed that there was nothing I wanted more than to eat, endlessly, recklessly. And when I drank, I was ashamed that there was nothing I wanted more than to drink. Trying to control my drinking only illuminated how deep that wanting went, like tossing a stone down a well and never hearing it hit bottom. During one of her binges, Jean Reese threw a brick through a neighbor's window. In her own defense, Reese later said the woman's dog, a killer and a fighter, had attacked her cat. The world Reese lived in, or the world as Reese lived in it, was always out to get her. One friend compared her self-pity to a gramophone needle stuck in a groove, going over and over miseries of one sort and another. In a 1931 review subtitled, The Pursuit of Misery in Some of the New Novels, Rebecca West wrote that Reese has proved herself to be enamored of gloom to an incredible degree. A profile of Reese in The Guardian appeared under the title, Fated to be Sad. But Reese didn't think of her work as particularly sad. She just thought it was the truth. She resented that interviewers always pushed her into a predestined role, the role of victim. She'd often had enough of herself. She signed a woeful letter to one of her best friends, End of Moan in Minor. Everyone saw the characters in her books as victims, she told one interviewer, and I don't like that. Everyone's a victim in a way, aren't they? To Reese, it seemed more like she was the only one willing to speak plainly. I'm a person at a masked ball without a mask. The only one without a mask. Eventually, she put out a declaration of rights against her interviewers. I am not an ardent women's libber, or a victim, eternally, or a darned fool. Reese never wanted to be a victim, eternally. I love that parenthetical. She still wanted to reserve the right to be a victim, sometimes. Reese's first biographer, Carol Angier, called her one of the century's greatest self-pity artists. But her second biographer leapt to her defense. I do not see self-pity in Reese's work or her life, wrote Lillian Pizzicini. I see an angry woman who had good reason to be angry and whose vision was bleak. But defending Reese by saying her work and life held no self-pity is like defending a spider by claiming it never hurt a fly. The spider's grace comes from how it kills the fly, with its intricate web. And Reese's grace came not from her refusal of self-pity, but from her merciless portraits of its grip. Always full of invention, never cluttered by apology. Reese was constantly dissecting self-pity by pulling apart the threads of its alibis. Her female characters were her hair shirts. Through them, Reese could pity herself, scold herself, humiliate herself, and martyr herself. She was still the little girl who'd smashed the face of her doll, then mourned it. Her self-pity wasn't a needle stuck in a single gramophone groove, because the song was always changing. One of her characters imagines her own face as a tortured and tormented mask that she can take off any time she likes, or wear under a tall hat with a green feather. This isn't self-pity served straight up, but with a twist, with a green feather perched over its unsightly features. Defending Reese's work by insisting it holds no self-pity already accepts the premise that self-pity must be entirely repressed. Another version of Lewis Hyde's claim that the Dream Song spent too much time on an alcoholic's pity pot. But both Reese and Berryman refuse to ignore the pity pot in its ugliness and shame as part of pain itself. Starting to drink again wasn't responsible for my self-pity. I'd managed to pity myself in sobriety as well. But booze certainly ignited it, and at a party that fall, it burst fully into flame. This was just before the start of our second year in Iowa. I'd been sitting on the kitchen stairs, with my crutches leaning against the steps beside me, talking to a poet who was looking at me funny. "Which eye do you want me to look into when I'm talking to you?" he asked. "What?" I said. He was drunk and I was drunk, but still. He launched into a whole story about how he used to live in Boston and there was a guy he knew there with a wandering eye, how everyone had just pretended it wasn't there, his wandering eye, which only made the whole thing worse, and this guy didn't want to do that with me. "But I don't have a wandering eye," I said. He said, quite kindly, "It's nothing to be ashamed of." I grabbed my crutches and crutched my way across the room to Dave, pulling him into the bathroom. "Tell me the truth," I said. "Do I have a wandering eye? Have I always?" I felt betrayed. I fixed my gaze on him. "Is my eye wandering right now?" Then I called my mom from the porch, drunk and crying. "You have to tell me," I said. "Have you been lying to me my whole life?" "What are you talking about?" she asked. And then, after a beat, "Where are you? Are you okay?" Although I didn't actually have a wandering eye, I became convinced I could actually feel my eyeball rolling around in my head, as if that's what a wandering eye would feel like. Maybe my eye wandered only when I got drunk enough, like a terrible poker tell. For days, I obsessed over it, this secret the whole world had been keeping from me. I hated seeing people from meetings around town, but it was a small town, so it happened all the time. I did surgical strikes on the booze aisle of the Hy-Vee, in and out, so that nobody from meetings could pass by and catch me standing there. An abject failure. Just doing some research. That's what people in recovery called it when you started drinking again. At the Java House one night, I saw a guy from meetings doing step work with his sponsee. Or rather, he spotted me. "How are you?" he asked. And I blushed instinctively, hearing, "Has your drinking gotten bad again?" "I'm so great," I said, then realized my voice was too loud, so made it softer, sincere. "I'm just really, really great." After The Lost Weekend became a bestseller, everyone wanted Charles Jackson to write a sequel, a novel that would explain how Don got out of it. As Jackson's former doctor put it, this sequel might fall into the hands of someone whom it would help. Jackson tentatively titled this sequel The Working Out, but he wasn't enthusiastic about it. As he told an AA group years later, he didn't think literature was meant to solve psychiatric problems. Also, there was the fact that Jackson hadn't entirely gotten out of it himself. He started taking pills a few years after The Lost Weekend was published, and then relapsed on booze in 1947, when he finally surrendered to the craving for an ice-cold beer while on vacation in the Bahamas. "What do you know?" he told his wife, Rhoda. "I'm drinking again." Bud Wister, the counselor who had coached Jackson through the Peabody Method a decade earlier, died during a bender that same year after swallowing broken glass from a whiskey bottle whose neck he'd smashed, drunk. As the famously sober author of a wildly successful book about alcoholism, Jackson was under pressure to keep up appearances. "Nothing could make me take another drink," he wrote a year after his relapse, in a 1948 promotional brochure put out by his publishing house. "My house could burn down, my capacities could fail, my wife and children could be killed, and I still would not drink." But the truth came out anyway. "Author of Lost Weekend loses one himself," ran one headline, after Jackson, driving drunk, drifted across a lane divider and crashed into another car head-on. In certain ways, the success of Jackson's novel about alcoholism had made it more difficult to maintain his sobriety. After his 1947 relapse, Rhoda wrote in desperation to Jackson's brother, Boom, "I realized yesterday how he managed to stop drinking. He held on to the fact that he was a great writer and he'd show everybody. When he got fame, that thing that sustained him all the time was gone, and he has nothing yet to replace it." Of course, The Lost Weekend hadn't exactly promised a happy ending. At the close of the book, Don pours himself a drink and crawls into bed. No telling what might happen next time, but why worry about that? Jackson was so committed to ending Don's story without any guarantee of salvation that he fought vehemently against the closing shot of the movie version, Billy Wilder's Oscar-winning 1945 adaptation, which shows a sober Ray Milland stubbing out his cigarette in a tumbler of whiskey, finis to that, and sitting down at a typewriter to begin composing the story we've just watched. Despite all the film's awards, it won an Academy Award for Best Picture, Milland won for Best Actor, Wilder won for Best Director, and he and Charles Brackett won for their adapted screenplay, Jackson was outraged by what they'd changed. Chaz and Billy based their movie version far less on the book than on what they happened to know about me personally, he wrote to a friend. And it's false and untrue at that, for the implication is that I overcame my drink problem by writing a book about it and thus getting it out of my system. Jackson didn't just hate the fact of this happy ending, but the means of it. He hated that the movie peddled false faith in the idea of narrative as salvation. That fall, 4 months after I started drinking again, I drove to another writing residency, this one in Wyoming. My relief at drinking far from home was almost ecstatic. Near the Badlands and their striated towers of rock, I found paradise, a tiny roadside motel, the neon vacancy glowing, with nothing for miles but the only thing I needed, a small bar across the street. The bartender filled my tumblers with double shots, unprompted, in a glowing, cozy room with faux log plank rafters, and I knew no one, and only had to stumble across the street onto scratchy sheets, no apologies necessary. In Wyoming, I drank with the artists in their studios, stumbled home across the cow fields one night, and tripped face first onto the metal bars of a cattle grid. And I drank with the writers at a place called the Mint Bar, full of cattle-branded cedar shingles, marked by a glowing neon cowboy astride a bucking neon horse, where no one had ever heard me say, "I'm an alcoholic." On the drive back home through South Dakota, I was looking forward to one last anonymous night of drinking freely before I got back home to Dave, to stopping at the same motel and going to the same bar across the street, with its leather seats and green lamps, its wooden counters smooth as maple syrup. But I couldn't find the right exit, and eventually ended up at a Super 8 in Chamberlain, where the rooms faced the parking lot and I didn't feel like walking to the single bar I'd seen a mile down the road. So I drove to a gas station and bought 2 6-packs of Mike's Hard Lemonade, perhaps because it was the thing I'd be most ashamed to drink with anyone I knew. The woman at the register eyed my 2 6-packs. "I can't drink this stuff," she said. "Makes me fucking sick." "My friends like it," I said, shrugging. Something about the exchange peeled the skin off my evening and exposed the venture as pathetic. Why was I so hell-bent on drinking hard lemonade alone in a shitty motel in South Dakota? I brought the 6-packs into my room, but they regarded me accusingly, a sign of failure. I took the 6-packs back to the trunk of my car, just to prove to myself that I didn't have to drink them. I didn't have to drink anything. I sat in my motel room for about 5 minutes before I went back out to the car, grabbed the 6-packs from the trunk and carried them halfway to the door, thought, "This is crazy, why can't I just decide?" and then turned around and put them back in the trunk. Then I decided that if I was this obsessed, I should just go ahead and drink them. So I popped the trunk, brought the 6-packs inside, turned on the motel TV, pulled the chain lock, and carried myself into the sweet, nauseating gauze of a hard lemonade drunk. That fall, I put an incredible amount of effort into talking to my therapist about everything but drinking. I told her stories about my fights with Dave, but carefully talked around the booze, a tumor I'd excised. I was also starting to cut myself again, like the holes you cut in the crust of a pie to let out the steam as it bakes. One day, Dave caught sight of the cuts on my ankles and asked if I wanted to talk about it. I said I didn't. The pages of my diary were filling up with drunken scrawls. "I believe there are things in me that are beautiful. When is enough?" Then farther down, the writing bigger and messier. "I know I've drunk a bottle and a half of wine," and the end trailing off. Another night. I just want, I don't know. And I didn't. When I finally told my therapist about the drinking, it was because I was tired of running laps around it. "It gets so bad when I'm drunk," I told her, and started crying and couldn't stop. I was already thinking about how our conversation was going to pollute my drinking that night, like a piece of hair stuck in the back of my throat. I asked her what she saw when she looked at me. "Shame," she said. "There is no other word for what I see on your face." By the time Billie Holiday finally collapsed, she was 44 and past the point of curing. This was the summer of 1959. Weakened by years of heroin abuse and suffering acutely from cirrhosis of the liver, she was emaciated and covered with old track marks. Her legs were pocked with ulcers from injections. After getting checked into Metropolitan Hospital in New York, she told a friend, "You watch, baby. They are going to arrest me in this damn bed." And they did. Narcotics agents found, or planted, a tinfoil pouch of heroin in her hospital room and handcuffed her to the bed. There were 2 policemen stationed by the door. Her mugshot and fingerprints were taken in that room at Metropolitan. During the preceding years, Holiday's last few albums had met with mixed reactions. Some fans thought her late voice was a betrayal of its former glory, an open wound, vocal cords flayed, husky from years of smoking and self-abuse. Others found this voice raw and moving, a distillation of her essence all along, the purest form of her. But almost everyone heard, in this late voice, a ledger of her trauma, an audible record of everything she'd endured and done to herself. While recording her last album, Lady in Satin, she drank gin from a water pitcher. Before one recording session, she pulled out a pint and said, "Now I'm going to eat breakfast." Ray Ellis, who did her musical arrangements near the end of her life, was disappointed when they first met. "I had seen pictures of her 10 years before, and she was a beautiful woman. When I met her, she was a repulsive woman. She looked a little shabby, a little dirty. I was taken aback because I had this mental thing, like she turns you on and you can go to bed with her. But I didn't think I could have gone to bed with her at that stage for anything. She was supposed to be beautiful and damaged, but instead, for Ellis, her damage had ruined her beauty. Her self-destruction was no longer luminous. When Studs Terkel saw her at a Southside Chicago club in 1956, he noticed other customers were also crying in their beer and shot glasses and insisted something was still there, something that distinguishes an artist from a performer, the revealing of self. Here I be, not for long, but here I be. But the self Holiday revealed in her songs, the hurt and wounded self that people heard when they listened to her, the self they wanted to hear and in some part constructed for themselves, that self was only part of her. There were other parts, too. She'd always wanted a family, had fantasized about buying a farm in the country and taking in orphans. She tried to breastfeed her godson from breasts that didn't have milk and tried to adopt a child in Boston. But the judge wouldn't allow her because of her drug record. Pregnant as a teenager, she had spent 18 hours in a mustard bath to try to end the pregnancy because her mother didn't want her to have a baby before she was married. But she later told a friend, "The only thing I ever wanted is that baby." While she lay handcuffed to her hospital bed, protesters outside Metropolitan held up signs, "Let Lady live." And on the July day she died, 6 weeks after she was admitted, Frank O'Hara wrote, "Everyone and I stopped breathing." A year after my first AA meeting, I found myself drunk in a bathroom stall in Mexicali, snorting coke off the flat top of the toilet paper dispenser. This was at a literary conference where I'd done some of my freest drinking in months, sitting on metal bleachers in the twilight, passing a flask back and forth with my new friend, the Peruvian novelist, dancing until 3 a.m. at a blacktop playground disco with a guy spinning records by the swings. At one point I thought, if I had stayed sober, I would have a year right now. Back home, Dave and I threw a party we called Octopotluck. It was October. It was a potluck. We were serving octopus. We bought it frozen in a big block of ice and handed out little paper cups like shots full of sautéed tentacles. We cooked it in hell, as we'd learned in Italy, back at the beginning. In the 2 years since, we'd put so many kinds of fish in hell. Tilapia in hell, flounder in hell, orange roughy in hell. If it was white and boneless, we'd probably put it in hell. If Dave had proposed that first summer, I would have said yes. But Octopotluck was proof of the fallen world. Now our kitchen was full of the other girls he was flirting with, drinking gin out of my special teacups. "Those teacups are special to me," I muttered to no one. Drunk, I started hunting for the old hurts with the heat-seeking missile of my fearful heart. Dave ignoring me, Dave and other women, Dave versus the hypothetical, impossible man who could plug whatever leak had sprung inside me. My heart skittered with accusations. "You cultivate your students' adoration. You cultivate their flirtation. You love that your enjambment lecture helps them understand their relationships with their fathers." I never ate any octopus. I woke to a familiar mess of fragments the next morning. Bathroom wall, gritty linoleum, cool porcelain of the toilet throat, hallway slanting like a fun house, me and Dave in the corner of our crowded kitchen, me accusing him of needing praise so badly, my voice dripping with venom, him saying, "I think this is the alcohol talking," as I tried to open my mouth to explain that it wasn't. Part of me still believed that real drinking stories demanded big tragedies, more broken noses and blood on the streets, fire explosions you could see clearly against the horizon. My drinking wasn't that. I hadn't set off a bomb in the middle of my own life. It had just grown small and curdled. I lived with shame like another organ nestled inside me, swollen with banal regrets, remembering the chicken I'd half-cooked drunk the night before, picturing the wet pink flesh at the core of each breast and imagining the spores of bacteria growing in our guts, or waking up 5 minutes before a 7 o'clock bakery shift to find my windshield coated with thick ice, then driving to work with my head stuck out the window, glad for the cold wind ventilating my hangover. Dave went back home to Boston for Thanksgiving, and I stayed to help with the bakery pie rush. While he was gone, I often found myself at the grocery store buying large amounts of alcohol. There was always a reason. When I showed up at my best friend's house for Thanksgiving in the early afternoon, she was worried there wasn't enough booze. Could I go out and buy some? Sure, I said, but maybe someone else should drive. I said I'd had a glass of wine while I was cooking. I didn't say it was a giant plastic soda cup that I'd poured most of the bottle into, saving a bit so that I wouldn't have drunk a whole bottle before noon. Someone else drove. We picked up a 30-pack of PBRs. I was happy we'd gotten beer because I didn't even like beer, and this made me feel less alcoholic because if I was really alcoholic, I'd only be buying alcohol I was going to drink. This was just alcohol for other people, so they wouldn't drink the alcohol I'd gotten for myself. At the meal, when I was bringing another bottle of wine back to the table, I knocked over my glass and it splintered into my food. Tiny shards of glass sparkled in my stuffing. My true self, clumsy, desperate to be drunker, had shown herself for a moment, like a wild animal peeking out from the underbrush, foolish and fumbling. I got another glass of wine but didn't bother to replace my turkey. When I went to pick up Dave from the airport, I stopped at the recycling dump to drop off all my empties, then drove from one life to another, from the cold, stinking circle of dumpsters, with broken glass underfoot and bottles sliding out of my hands, shattering into their bins, to the warmth of our car, and Dave on the airport curb, scarf-wrapped and red-cheeked from the cold. I loved when we were apart and missed each other, but I knew he'd been missing somebody other than the person I'd become. On my last night of drinking, we had Dave's poetry students over for dinner, and I drank steadily in the kitchen, losing track of how many bouillon cubes I'd added to my chicken noodle soup. It ended up saltier than tears. A female student who sometimes texted Dave to see which bar he was drinking at, "Why did you give her your number?" I'd asked him once, sat on our orange couch and recited all of The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock from memory. I was swollen with booze and indignation. "It's so totally predictable to memorize Prufrock. That's my orange couch." I couldn't wait for his students to leave, but couldn't kick them out. They left one by one, impossibly slowly. When Dave took the last stragglers down to the front porch to smoke, I thought, "Finally," and carried a big plastic cup of whiskey to my office. I don't know how long I was in there before he came in. I remember he showed me an email he'd just gotten from one of his students, who had written him, clearly drunk, after getting home from wherever she'd been drinking after she'd been at our house, to say she was depressed. She needed help. All this is blurry. Months later, this same girl would leave a drunken voicemail on Dave's phone saying she was in love with him and wanted to kill herself, and he called 911 because he was afraid she would. That night, he just wrote back to her and to the dean of his department to say he was worried. I don't remember if he asked me what he should do or if he just did it. I remember thinking some people in the world were crying out for help and other people were giving it, and I wanted to be one of the people giving it, but I was one of the people crying out for it instead. I also wanted Dave to realize I was bottoming out and somehow this other girl had stolen my bottom. I told him the drinking had gotten bad again and I didn't know what to do about it, and I was sorry for the way we fought. I didn't want to fight. I hated fighting. And he sat beside me on the futon and wrapped his arms around me, and I buried my face in his chest, which seemed more honest than trying to say anything. I made weird little animal sounds against him and tried not to wipe my nose with his flannel shirt. "We're not having a fight tonight," he said. "You were wonderful tonight." Sometimes it hurts to remember how selfish I was, how completely cocooned, and how good he was to me. The rest of the night went fuzzy. At some point I was stumbling down the hallway. At some point he told me his student was okay. I thought, great. At some point, I stood over my pot of soup on the stove and picked out noodles and clumps of shredded chicken with my fingers, stuffing them into my mouth, then knelt by the toilet for a while. I'm not sure if I threw up or not. I know I went back into my office with more booze. I thought, this has to be the last night. It was just like the other one. The last night I'd already had, holing myself up with a big red cup of whiskey. Except this time, I brought the bottle too, just to be safe.
9. Confession. The first day of my second sobriety, I crashed my friend's car into a concrete wall. I'd borrowed his car because ours wasn't starting and I needed to get to my morning shift at the hospital so that medical students could diagnose my fake appendicitis. It was a frozen December day and I was jumpy and nervous, hungover and jittery. I need to stop. I don't want to stop. Stopping didn't work last time. My hands were having trouble staying still. And then I pulled into a parking space and hit the accelerator instead of the brakes and slammed right into the concrete wall. I remember thinking, oh shit. And then I wondered if I could pretend it hadn't happened. Do I definitely have to tell him? And yes, I did, because the front bumper was dangling like a loose band-aid and one of the headlights had been cracked into a glass web. My immediate impulse was simply to back out and pull into another parking space, as if that would give me a do-over. I was trying to do the right thing, after all. Get sober again. And today was supposed to be my big watershed, the first day of the rest of my life. Now my reward for those intentions was this battered station wagon. I was indignant. If I was going to stop drinking, I was supposed to discover a spectacular new version of myself. Or at least recover the presence of mind not to accelerate into a concrete wall. But sobriety didn't work like that. It works like this. You go to work. You call your friend. You say, I'm sorry I crashed your car into a wall. You say you'll fix it. Then you do. Why do you deserve another chance? One drug court judge asked his defendant, an addict trying to explain his latest relapse. There's hope, said the defendant. What makes you think you have hope now? The defendant said he was getting clean for his kids. He had to give a reason it was different this time. How is life different? I have better coping skills and listen more. Do you still know everything? No, I'm open-minded now. Humble? The judge asked. Willing to listen now? The defendant laughed and shook his head. It's been a personal challenge, the defendant admitted. I thought I knew everything. It's an uncomfortable ritual. The addict asked to perform his humility, expected to regard the judge as both therapist and punisher. It's just one of many ways that drug courts, the American legal system's main concession to the possibility that there might be something to do with addicts besides locking them up, still live imperfectly inside their ideals. One of the ways they still treat addiction as a form of failure. In drug court, the judge and defendant are meant to collaboratively construct the person the defendant is supposed to become, not just someone recovering, but someone who sincerely desires this recovery. But sociologists find that drug courts are full of tongue lashings from judges. I'm tired of your excuses. I'm through with you. Some defendants are treated as salvageable, while others are deemed irremediably deficient. Part of proving that you're truly ready to recover in drug court, in a meeting, in a memoir, involves admitting that you don't know if you can recover at all. Part of getting into the right narrative involves admitting you can't see the end of it. Like the Narco Farm reports, prognosis guarded. In Lady Sings the Blues, Billie Holiday warns her readers against believing her own tentative happy ending. There isn't a soul on this earth who can say for sure that their fight with dope is over until they're dead. In the afterword to Beautiful Boy, a memoir about his son Nick's recovery from meth addiction, journalist David Sheff confesses that Nick relapsed again after the book was published. Yes, Nick relapsed, he writes. Sometimes I tire of the convoluted, messy truth. Sheff's afterword doesn't just disrupt the provisional happy ending we've just read, it disrupts the possibility of any certain ending. This is a staple of the addiction memoir genre. The afterword, the epilogue, the author's note confessing that since first publication, things have not gone entirely as hoped. But confessing uncertainty outright, saying, "No soul on earth can say for sure," isn't cynicism. It offers an honest hope that doesn't depend on something impossible, knowing the end of the story before it comes. It's more ragged than Bill Wilson's mountaintop vision, and it's a more frustrating story to tell. Just as so many stories I heard at meetings over the years involved countless cycles and repetitions. That's how humility gets built into hope. Old-timers sober for 40 years say, "With any luck, I'll stay sober till the end of one more day." When I came back to my first meeting, I said, "When I started drinking again, I promised myself I'd never come back to a meeting. Now I'm here." Iowa City is a small town. When I returned to meetings, I knew I'd see the same people. It made me anxious. They would remember how I'd walked in a year earlier, full of desperation and pathos, and then quit their solution. Now I was back, my sadness stale, my case compromised. It made me picture Civil War deserters branded with a D at the hip, or forced to wear wooden signs proclaiming their cowardice. But everyone was happy to see me. People said, "Glad you're back." Some said, "It was like that for me too." A woman I'd known the first time around knelt on the floor next to my chair and said, "You never have to drink again." And I thought, never have to? Drinking was all I wanted to do. I wanted to do it right then. Years later, I looked back and saw the truth of what she'd said, that I'd taken one step away from that tight crawl space full of endless scheming and apologizing, deciding and redeciding. But that first night back, the trap was still the thing I desired most. It made me anxious that the first thing I'd heard didn't ring true at all. Had it been a ridiculous mistake to come back? But I was crying. I was a wreck, and that woman had seen that whatever I was in the middle of, I was desperate for relief from it. Relief came from sitting still and listening. That night, a man talked about getting drunk for the first time when he was 12, babysitting his little sisters one night, how he broke into his parents' liquor stash, then ate a whole bag of licorice and woke up in a puddle of his own black vomit. He talked about how his diabetic wife had died of a blood infection 6 weeks after he left her. She'd stepped on a piece of glass, drunk, had to get her toes amputated, and then her foot. Then she died. That really sent him off. Survivor's guilt, he said. He also had that from working in the Marriott World Trade Center on 9/11. After he made it home that day, he turned on the news and drank a whole bottle of wine, then checked how many bottles he had left, in case the world was ending. Hearing his voice in that church basement, above the scrape of metal chair legs across linoleum and the percolations of the coffee maker, I listened to his story as a writer, for its themes and climax, but I mainly heard it another way, as a woman who still wanted to drink more than she wanted to do anything else. During the zenith of his involvement in AA, during the mid-1950s, Charles Jackson started to believe that recovery was inspiring him to write in a new way. He had a new angle on the book he was writing, an approach committed to simplicity and honesty, and wrote to one friend that his stopping drinking and enormous interest in AA had a lot to do with this new attitude. At that point, Jackson was working on the book he imagined would become his magnum opus, an epic called What Happened, a novel of affirmation and acceptance of life that would tell the story of his old anti-hero, Don Burnham, once he'd left all his lost weekends behind him. The epic's first installment, titled Farther and Wilder, would begin with a 200-page overture constructed around the central event of a massive family reunion. Don would be host to the gathering. They should come to him and be his guests, and he would not only take care of them all, but be able to take care of them all. Jackson wanted to write a different Don than the one the world knew from the lost weekend. This Don would be stable and affluent, not only taking care of his family, but able to take care of them. The syntax is poignant in its repetition. Jackson had been stymied by the book for years. His biographer Blake Bailey has observed that Jackson was a master of working on every conceivable thing but this novel. But in the months after Jackson got involved in AA in 1953, he was finally able to generate more than 200 pages. As he wrote to a friend, "It's far and away the best thing I've done, simpler, more honest, and, for the first time, out of myself. That is, not self-tortured or absorbed or eviscerated. No, it's about people. Life, if I may say so. My stopping drinking and my enormous interest in AA, if you'll pardon the expression, have a lot to do with this new attitude. Well, everything to do with it, I think." The novel was anchored in the ordinary texture of a sober alcoholic's daily experience. "I can put it best," Jackson told his editor, Roger Strauss, "by saying the story happens, is happening, taking place, like daily living, on every page." He wanted to write a novel that humbled its content by taking up the topic of ordinary people and ordinary living, as well as its style, by resisting the siren call of virtuosic performance. These were both ways of trying to write away from his ego. In another letter to Strauss, Jackson described his approach. "It is really wonderful, simple, plain, human, life itself, nothing in the dazzling intellectual class. But unless you are James Joyce, the relaxed novel is good enough." Jackson wanted to believe his novel could be wondrous in its attention to ordinary human life, but he was also worried. You can hear the doubt seeping into his justifications. Although he argued that the novel can do just about what it pleases, and announced, "I please to make it plain, like everyday people," his underlined "I" suggested a fragile sense of his own prerogative. It was as if his social self-consciousness about his AA fellows, who were, as his wife said, not very bright or interesting or anything, had its corollary in his anxiety about whether this new style would seem ambitious or intellectual enough. At times, he openly confessed his anxiety that this approach of life unfolding moment by moment could seem careless and rambling, or just marked by a total lack of originality, the very lack of originality that AA was teaching him to embrace. Jackson's conflicted attitude toward the project had everything to do with the split he perceived between the spheres of literature and recovery. How could he write a novel that would satisfy the demands of both? He feared the judgment of a shrewish literati that wasn't much like the crowd at his AA meetings, people whose ethos of fellowship had asked him to imagine himself into their everyday lives and away from his own. If Jackson had gotten drunk because he couldn't get outside himself, as he would tell AA crowds, then getting out of himself in the novel translated this newfound sense of sober purpose into prose. As he wrote to one friend, he wanted all of it outside of myself, outside. It was a curious claim for Jackson to make that his project, another semi-autobiographical novel, was somehow leaving his own life behind. The AA ethos was key to these paradoxical ambitions, the belief that every person was simply a vehicle for delivering a story, and the faith that illuminating your own life was a way to be of service beyond yourself. That first winter of my second sobriety, my sponsor gave me a chart to fill out for my fourth step, which involved making an inventory of all my resentments. "Just that," I joked. "How long do you have?" She smiled patiently and said, "Trust me, I've seen worse." My sponsor, Stacy, was a funny, generous woman who'd gotten sober before she was legal. She was nothing like me, except that neither of us had ever wanted to drink any other way besides a deep dive into drunk. She was matter-of-fact about her own experiences and listened patiently to my rambling, comprehensive monologues, nodding but not particularly impressed, often distilling them to their core urgencies. "So you were afraid of being left." Her distillations weren't reductions. They captured something it was useful for me to see starkly, without the webbing of so much language. Every time I thanked her profusely for taking the time to meet with me, she told me the same thing. This keeps me sober, too. When I first got into AA, I had been told to choose a sponsor who had what I wanted. I sensed this didn't mean a Pulitzer Prize. I eventually chose Stacy not because she reminded me of myself, but because she didn't. She moved through the world with assurance, helpful without seeming righteous, humble without excess apology. It felt viscerally good to be around her ease, like silk against the skin. She was not ashamed to confess the size of her love for her Pomeranian. We shared a sense of humor, both laughed at the part of Bill's story in the Big Book where he said he'd never been unfaithful while he was drinking, out of loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness. We liked that he confessed the less than noble reason, too. Stacy and I had worked together before my relapse, and when I decided to get sober again, she and her fiancé had taken me to my first meeting back. "Thank you for giving me another chance," I'd gushed, thinking it was all about our connection. "Of course," she'd said. "That's how the program works." When it came to my fourth step, I was anxious about the format of the list, a spreadsheet with extremely narrow columns, because I wasn't sure how I'd tell the full story of each item I was listing. "Some of my situations are pretty complicated," I explained. "So are everyone's," my sponsor said. "I'm sure you'll manage." The fourth step was supposed to include all my harms and resentments, but I asked Stacy if I was supposed to list people I resented, even if I hadn't caused them any harm. She smiled. I was clearly not the first alcoholic who had asked this question. "Anyone who gives you a knot in your gut," she said. The chart had a column asking me to link each of my resentments to a motivating fear. Fear of conflict, fear of abandonment, and I filled it out dutifully, always a model student, fear of inadequacy. I hadn't done an inventory during my first sobriety, and it was part of my attempt to do things differently this time around. The inventory wasn't about asking for absolution for my sins. It was about bringing discomfort into the light, all the toxic grudges that might make me want to drink again. Listing them was like emptying a cluttered drawer. When I looked back at what my drinking had been, I saw someone hurling herself at the world, asking it to give her back to herself with some edges. I saw myself standing in a man's doorway, my body thrilling with coke and already smarting with disappointment, practically begging him to kiss me. My sister-in-law had once asked me, "Would you rather have no bones or no skin?" And at first it made me picture a creature without bones, a shapeless dough blob of flesh, and then a creature without skin, a taut sculpture of glistening nerves and muscles. How would you describe the creature without either? Just totally fucked? Sometimes I suspected I had no structure, at other times, no boundaries. I looked back at the girl in the doorway, waiting to be kissed, and wanted to clap a hand over her mouth, to shake the coke from her nose and drain the vodka from her stomach, to say, "Don't say that. Don't drink that. Don't need that." Except I couldn't, because she did say that, drink that, need that. She wasn't the only one with needs. This was part of my inventory, too, accepting that I wasn't the only victim of my insecurities. In the chart called Sexual History Inventory, the most telling column was this one. Whom did I hurt? It wasn't just telling because it was full of names, but because most of them were followed by question marks. I'd rarely paid enough attention to know whether I'd hurt them or not. My insecurity had convinced me I didn't have the power to hurt anyone. By the time I was ready to go over my chart with Stacy, this was the fifth step, talking about the fourth step inventory with someone else. I was in the recent aftermath of another surgery, a procedure to fix residual damage in my nose from the time I'd been punched. I'd shared about the surgery in a meeting, hoping for sympathy, but the main thing I got was, "Be careful with your painkillers." It turned out to be good advice. I was surprised by how much I looked forward to the drugs that would knock me out, and the ones I'd get afterward, by how obsessively I'd imagined the possibility of laughing gas or Valium. It was like a surge through my belly, this anticipation, unbidden and unexpected. In meetings, people sometimes said, "Your disease is always waiting for you outside. It's out there doing push-ups." I pictured alcoholism as a small man with a mustache and a wife beater. It turns out I didn't even get the pre-op stuff I'd been hoping for, nitrous oxide or Valium. All my anesthesia did for me was make me vomit after the surgery into a bucket Dave held beside me. He'd been there for me, over and over again. And in sobriety, it was getting easier to see that, easier to tell him I was grateful for that tenderness. The night before I was supposed to do my fifth step, my face was still bandaged. I hadn't taken any Vicodin, too scared of how much I wanted to take them all, or at least enough to make the whole world swim. I was on a zero-salt diet to bring down my swelling, subsisting largely on a mixture of Cheerios, walnuts, and dried cherries, like a vain little squirrel. I texted Stacy suggesting that maybe we should postpone our session for a few weeks. "Are you physically able to speak?" she asked. I told her I was. "Then let's do it," she said. So the next day we sat across from each other at my kitchen table. I put out a little bowl of Cheerios and cranberries. I poured us glasses of water. My chart lay on the table between us, its boxes reductive and true. It felt useful to look at my regrets in terms of fear rather than selfishness. Perhaps it was just a question of seeing how often selfishness, mine and everyone's, was motivated by fear. I started explaining the first situation on my inventory, in all of its nuance and complexity, its layers of guilt and shame and... "Just the short version," she said. "Keep it simple." Through the course of his attempts to stay sober, Berryman took many personal inventories. 1. What has bothered me most about myself all my life, whether I would be a great poet or not? 2. What bothers me most about myself at the present time? Poverty of love for others. 3. What bothers me most about myself in relation to the future? Whether I can overcome this? No surprise, perhaps, that Berryman's final book of poetry was called Love and Fame. During the last 4 years of his life, he went to rehab 4 times, detoxed at hospitals, went to countless meetings, and even chaired one at a local prison, inviting the prisoners to have dinner at his house when they got out. One took him up on it. He read piles of AA literature. He filled out charts and checklists. Every one of his monthly inventories from Hazelden was full of check marks and X's. He put little crosses next to self-importance, dishonesty, and false pride. Next to resentment, he wrote, "Hurts oneself, always for the unchangeable." He underlined the immoral in immoral thinking. He was immersed in the so-called Minnesota model, what we now call rehab, in the heart of Minnesota, residential treatment in the land of 10,000 treatment centers. The AA first step that Berryman completed the first time he arrived at St. Mary's Hospital in Minneapolis gives a sense of the wasteland his drinking had become. "Wife left me after 11 years of marriage because of drinking. Despair, heavy drinking alone, jobless, penniless, seduced students drunk. My chairman told me I had called up a student drunk at midnight and threatened to kill her. Drunk in Calcutta, wandered streets lost all night, unable to remember my address. Many alibis for drinking. Severe memory loss, memory distortions. DTs once in Abbott, lasted hours. Quart of whiskey a day for months in Dublin working hard on a long poem. Wife hiding bottles, myself hiding bottles, wet bed drunk in London hotel, manager furious, had to pay for new mattress, lectured too weak to stand, had to sit, lectured badly prepared, defecated uncontrollably in a university corridor, got home unnoticed. My wife said, 'St. Mary's or else,' came here." There's a palpable heartbreak not only in the devastation of Berryman's drinking, but in his surprising regrets, not just shitting in a hallway, but also lecturing badly prepared. He was preparing better for recovery. Hence the piles of reading, the dutiful charts. In one fourth step, he made a list of his responsibilities. A. To God. Daily practice, submission of will, gratitude. I agree, it's one of my few lifelong virtues.